Thank the organizers, as everyone else has. This has been great so far. So I'm going to tell you about some work that we've been doing recently with Luca about taking corner symmetry seriously and studying the group theory involved, with the hope that this will lead us to quantum ideas for gravity, which is perhaps a novel viewpoint on quantum gravity. So the setting, of course, is that in gauge theories, charges have support in codimension 2. We all understand this. And in gravitational theories, or in diff invariant theories more generally, we say that diff m is a local symmetry. And this means that observables are invariant under diff m, presumably. And that means that nether charges corresponding to generic elements of diff m are almost certainly always zero. The question that we want to address here is which charges can have support, which diffeomorphisms can have non-zero charges in the presence of some geometric feature like a corner. Okay, and when Luca and I first studied this last year, we set up the problem in a way that was independent of any particular classical theory. It was just purely a geometric discussion. And in fact, it doesn't really even depend on a metric, although that's, you know, ultimately part of the story. Okay, so the discussion is independent of any dynamical details, and I think that's why this idea, this corner program, has promise. And one of the things that I want to emphasize, that I always emphasize in these talks, is that the world is quantum mechanical, right? It's not the case that we should think about the universe as being a classical arena that we have to quantize, okay? Instead, you should think about classical limits as just that. It's some effective emergent description that comes out of the quantum theory. Now, that's a very ambitious sort of statement to say, of course, right? Because, well, what is this quantum theory that I'm talking about? And so the hope of this program is that the corner symmetry will lead us somewhere interesting. Okay, so again, so we're trying to organize a quantum theory by symmetry. Okay, so just in way of an outline, what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin with a very short review of our view on corner symmetries and how they emerge. That could easily be a talk by itself, but I'm just going to give you some highlights. And there's some important features about integrability of charges and things like that, which I will mention, but won't have time to delve into deeply. The main topic is to set up a coadjoint orbit analysis for the full corner symmetry. In our original papers, we referred to the corner symmetry as, well, initially we referred to it as a maximal embedding algebra for reasons that I'll show you in a moment, and it became called the extended corner symmetry. I'm going to rebrand this a little bit I'm going to refer to a universal corner symmetry, and I'll explain the differences of these various symmetry groups as we go along. But it's this universal corner symmetry that emerges from this geometric investigation of corners. And it's sort of the underlying symmetry. Other versions of corner symmetry, as we'll see, sort of emerge out of this symmetry. Okay, so in fact, there are two important subalgebras. of that universal corner symmetry, which we refer to as the extended corner symmetry. This turns out to correspond to finite distance corners. For example, if you know, the boundary of a spatial subregion. And the second one is what we now call an asymptotic corner symmetry. And this course, well, it corresponds to asymptotic corners. And it's in this case where symmetries like BMSW may be embedded. Okay, so continuing the outline, so what I'm going to do is as I said, study the coadjoint orbits of the universal corner symmetry, and that leads us eventually, as I'll show you, to an interpretation, not in terms of a Lie algebra per se, but a Lie algebroid over a corner. Sorry, too far. Okay, so that's going to be the outcome, and that provides us with an interesting way to think about the representation theory. And so at the end of the talk, I'm going to at least begin a discussion of some quantum ideas that we may be able to pull out of this. Okay, and it turns out that representation theory that I referred to here leads to simple moment maps, okay, between the coadjoint orbits that I'm going to talk about and phase spaces, gravitational phase spaces, say. And these are directly interpreted in terms of, well, because they're representations, they're related to associated bundles. And I guess I should have emphasized that this discussion is really going to be group theoretic, right? We're not talking in terms of some covariant phase space construction. I don't care about a Lagrangian. In fact, I don't even care about a space-time. Okay, it's based entirely on the symmetry, and I think what we're identifying here can be thought of as the building blocks of a classical space-time. So this is the sense, this is the big idea, this is the sense in which there may be a quantum theory here from which we can build classical, semi-classical space-times. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about the universal corner symmetry. It is, as we originally defined it, it's the maximal finitely generated subalgebra of diff M that's associated with a corner. So a corner is a codimension 2 surface. And we thought about this from the point of view of embedding a corner in a classical space-time. It's important to pay attention to the details of the embedding. The embedded surface has separate coordinates from the coordinates in the space-time, and so I'm denoting the difference here. So I'm thinking of sigma as coordinates on the corner, and u and x, I'm sort of adapting coordinates to the corner. I'm calling the coordinates in the space-time u and x. You can think about the u coordinates as normal to the corner, and the x coordinates as tangential to the corner. So this is roughly speaking the same sort of setup that Laurent talked about yesterday, although the names are different. Okay, so in these adapted coordinates, you can write an arbitrary vector field in M as an expansion with arbitrary coefficients in the tangential and normal directions. And the idea is to expand those coefficients near the corner. Okay, and it turns out that if you do that and you truncate the expansion in the way that I've indicated here, then you find a closed subalgebra of diff M. And what that algebra is the universal corner symmetry. It contains diff S, which comes from the vector fields tangent to the surface, and there's a GL2R semi-direct R2 that come from the normal directions. Okay, and you can see here that I've kept in the expansion and powers of U, I've gone out only to linear order in U. Okay, so having truncated my vector fields like this, I'm certainly not describing vector fields that are far away from the corner, but the claim is that these are relevant to physics near the corner. So here in the blue box, I've shown you what the Lie bracket of these vector fields is. And if you look at the various terms, I'm referring to AK and GLK here because this actually works in codimension K. It's the same construction. You would get diff S, GLK, semi-direct RK in that case. Absolutely.
Wait.
Here. That was strong. So how dependent is this truncation on the coordinate system that you just chose?
What do you mean by that?
I mean, if you change the coordinate system, will you get another,
So it's controlled under a subset of diffeomorphisms.
Say again, sorry?
It's a controlled expansion under a subset of diffeomorphisms. In fact, we're going to see that there's a bundle structure here over S.
This truncation is stable under certain
under reparameterizations of X and under reparameterizations of U that are U and X dependent. Okay, but if I was to do diffeomorphisms where I changed X as a function of U, then this would certainly break down.
Right.
So that's I'm describing a bundle structure.
Right? Okay, thank you.
Okay, so what's the idea here? So the idea, as I said before, is that diff M is a gauge symmetry. But what you should take as the interpretation of the universal corner symmetry is that it contains the diffeomorphisms that could become physical in the presence of a corner. Okay, so the claim is that these are the transformations that were pure gauge in the bulk, but may become global in a sense in the presence of a corner. And corresponding to that, they may support in a classical theory, they may support Noether charges, okay, which would be realized as Hamiltonians on a suitable phase space. And I say could here, because in specific examples, it's actually only a certain subalgebra or a subset of the charges associated with this universal corner symmetry that are actually supported. And this has been known for several years, and it was sort of a mysterious fact. One of the things that'll emerge from the orbit analysis is an understanding of why this is happening. Okay, and as I say here, the fact that only a subset of the available charges actually take non-zero values in specific cases are correspond to properties of specific coadjoint orbits. Okay, so that's the universal corner symmetry, and the thing that I want you to focus on here is that this is a semi-direct product, but it includes a GL2. Okay, so in the orbit analysis, what we're going to find, I'm going to sort of tell you the answer here, we're going to find that there are certain subalgebras of that universal corner symmetry that come to prominence. And I've already referred to these. It turns out that the extended corner symmetry, which is a very similar group, except that the GL2 is replaced by SL2. We will see this emerge in the orbit analysis, and we think about an orbit of this group as associated with a finite distance corner. Okay, so if you like, you can think about the notion of a corner as sort of emerging from the group theory in this way. Okay, again, I'm just going to be doing abstract group theory. There's no space-time, there's no embedding any longer. And so notions like corners have to, well, it would be nice if they came out of the analysis. Okay, why does the group reduce? Well, for a finite distance corner, say a boundary of a spatial subregion, there's no scaling of fields involved. And consequently, what happens is that the overall trace element or the vial element of the GL2 actually decouples. It's just that the, you know, if you thought about a metric close to the corner, it wouldn't have vial charge, and so that decouples. The other subalgebra that emerges, oh, and I should have said this earlier, because of tech problems, I'm always going to refer to the corresponding group. Okay, so these are groups that I'm referring to, but the analysis is about the corresponding the algebras. Okay, so sorry about that. The asymptotic corner symmetry, on the other hand, is also contained in the full universal corner symmetry, but the GL2 is replaced by a GL1, or if you like, just a copy of R. And a nice way to think about why this group is relevant to asymptotic corners is that what we mean by an asymptotic corner is a situation where you have some scaling involved. Okay, so you know, a simple example, if you want to think about scry in an asymptotically flat space-time, there's a second order pole in the metric that you have to deal with, and consequently the fields, the various components of the metric, become charged under that vial subgroup. And in fact, in order to respect that second order pole, you have to get rid of the SL2R part. It would mess up that, if you kept the SL2R, it would mess up that boundary condition. Okay, so in this case, as I'll discuss a little bit later, symmetries like this is not BMSW, but it contains BMSW. Okay, and so the picture that will emerge is that BMSW is related to a certain orbit of this group. Okay, and it's a well-known story that, you know, depending on your, well, beliefs or whatever, you consider situations where diff S is reduced, you know, for example, to a conformal subalgebra or something like that. I won't bother with that discussion here. We're just thinking about generic diff S. Of course.
I missed the the difference between the generic GL2R that you had, and the finite distance where the GL is replaced with the SL. The generic, isn't that finite distance as well? The one where you had GL.
So the thing that I'm calling UCS is a group that has a similar texture, but there's a GL2 here.
Okay.
Okay, so GL2 you can think of as SL2 plus or times R, times the sort of trace element of GL2, okay, which is what I'm referring to here. And so in fact, what's happened is there's sort of complementary subgroups of GL2 appearing in the two cases. Did that answer your question?
Well, yeah.
Okay, so we're sort of, I'm fortunate in that we had a nice review by Andrea on Monday. So I will be able to hopefully speed up in the discussion of the orbit method. But one of the features that is going to be in the background at the end, when I refer to actual phase spaces and moment maps between coadjoint orbits and phase spaces, is the notion of extending the phase space, okay, to include edge modes, if you like. Now, as I said before, what I'm going to do is present a purely group theoretic analysis. Okay, so what I gave you up to now was a representation of the corner symmetries, right? That came from thinking about a corner as embedded in a classical space-time. And but from now on, we're going to dispense with that and just study the group theory directly. Okay, if you like, what I showed you can be thought of as a defining representation, but we want to understand the representation theory in more detail, in more generality. Okay, so I will skip this because, as I said, we've had a nice discussion of coadjoint orbits. Let me cut to the chase. It turns out to be useful to do the following thing in order to understand the coadjoint orbits. What I'm going to do is I want to study the coadjoint orbits of the full universal corner symmetry. But I'm going to begin by dispensing with the diff S part. Okay, and you can think about that as, you know, studying the Lie algebra of this group, which I'm going to call H. I'm studying the Lie algebra of that group sort of point by point in the space S, point by point on the corner. Okay, and similarly for the ECS and ACS, I'm going to refer to the non-diff part of that as H sub S and H sub W, and the corresponding Lie algebras I'll refer to as MathFrak H, HS, and HW. Okay, and then once we have a handle on that, it's not easy to understand the coadjoint orbits of this, but it certainly is tractable, as I'll show you. The reason that it's simple is that it's just just a Lie algebra. It's the Lie algebra of a six-dimensional group in the case of UCS. Okay, and in fact, you can think about this. I'll show you the details in a moment, but you can sort of think about this as just a generalization of a more familiar analysis of the coadjoint orbits or the little group analysis of the Poincaré group. Okay, in this case, you know, the Poincaré group in two dimensions is contained in this group. Okay, and so once we've understood what's going on there, I'm going to add back in the diff S, and the picture that is going to emerge is that it's useful to think about the coadjoint orbits of this group as actually the orbits of a Lie algebroid rather than just a Lie algebra.
Can I ask a question?
Yep.
At this stage, is the semi-Dirac structure fixed? I have in mind that, you know, in BMS, for instance, the super translation transformed with our density of given weights, and
yeah.
Here is it.
So if we go back to the defining representation. Okay, so this was just the Lie bracket of vector fields in space-time, and the semi-Dirac product structure is implied here by the fact that, you know, diff S is acting, where is it? Diff S is acting in these terms on the C0s, which are sort of the normal translations. So these terms correspond to diff S acting on R2, that's why it's semi-direct. The GL2 acts on the R2, that's here. Okay, it acts by matrix multiplication, etc. Okay, so at least in terms of this defining representation, yeah, the semi-directs are just defined from the space-time Lie brackets. Okay, is that?
Yeah, thanks.
Did I do it? Okay. Okay, so just to set up notation, I'm going to generically refer to elements of a Lie algebra by, you know, I'm going to write them as vectors, and I'll always use an underscore to represent that. As we heard on Monday, there's an action of a Lie algebra on itself through the add action. It's basically just the Lie bracket of the algebra. The dual of the Lie algebra consists of maps from the Lie algebra to the reals, and the pairing of those two vector spaces I'm going to write as M of mu. And the Lie algebra acts on the dual through the add star action, and that definition appears here. Okay, so these are the same equations we saw on Monday. I'm denoting elements of the dual algebra here by M, generically. Okay, as I said, I'm just going to be describing things at the algebraic rather than group level, so I'm not really tracing out full orbits. What I'm doing is you should think about M as defining a point in the dual space, and what I'm really doing here is I'm studying the tangent space to the orbit at that point. Okay, so you should think about add star mu of M as corresponding to a tangent vector that points in a direction that's determined by mu. Okay, so most of the time I'll write it like that, but you can think about this as, you can write it in this notation if you like, and you can think about this as the contraction of the vector mu with a one form on the cotangent space, on the coadjoint space, on the covector space. Okay, so what we can do then is we can study this add star action, and at the group level it would trace out an orbit. At the infinitesimal level, what we will see is a subspace of the full tangent space at that point. Okay, and so I'll call that O sub M. But that's the tangent space to the orbit. Okay, and the reason that this is so nice at the symplectic level is that the theorems are that G dual is generically a Poisson manifold, but the orbits themselves are symplectic, and there's a concise form for the symplectic form, the KKS symplectic form, which I'll write down later. Okay, so in this case, remember what by little UCS, I'm referring to GL2 semi-direct R2 now. So we're studying that Lie algebra. And what I'm gonna do is work in a basis of the Lie algebra that I will write as TAB. Those are basis vectors corresponding to the GL2, and TC, which are the basis vectors corresponding to the R2. Okay, so the A's and B's run over two values here. And the Lie algebra of these basis vectors is just given here. Okay, there's a certain invariant tensor that I've called pi here. The reason that I've written it that way is that this setup works for any of the corner symmetries. What's different about the different cases is the actual value of this tensor pi. Okay, in the case of GL2, it's just deltas, as it turns out. Okay, the dual basis I'm going to write in a similar way without underscores. And then typical elements of the Lie algebra I'm going to write in this way. Again, the t's are just basis vectors, so they have coefficients that I'm calling theta and b. Theta is an infinitesimal GL2, and the b is an infinitesimal R2 translation. And the corresponding dual elements, which I generically called m before, I'm going to expand in this basis, and the coefficients I'll call j and p. Okay, so the pairing of two such elements just reads as theta j plus bp, okay, which is a sort of familiar physics notation. Okay, and if you compute add star in this case at a point m or a Lie algebra element mu, you can just work out, since we know what the algebra is, we can just work out what it is. Okay, remember that add star mu m, that's a tangent vector, I'm gonna think about that as delta mu m. What you can do is you can translate that into deltas of the individual components. Okay, so that's what I'm writing here. So the add star action corresponds to a delta j for a given mu described by theta and b by this by this expression, and similarly delta p's are of that form. Okay, now the sort of remarkable thing about this system in the case of the UCS is that these equations turn out to be invertible. Okay, in other words, I can solve these equations for b and theta in terms of delta j and delta p. Here they are. They're sort of involved expressions. The details don't matter too much. But in order to do that, what I've done is I've introduced a tensor that I've referred to as kappa here. And you can think about that as the ratio of the tensor epsilon AB by a function on the on this covector space that I've referred to as C3. Okay, so the what happens here is that the epsilon AB is an invariant tensor, not of GL2, but of SL2. It actually has a vial weight under the full GL2. And similarly, C3 is not an invariant function of GL2, but it carries, it simply carries a vial weight. And the ratio of these two things is actually GL2 invariant. Okay, so that's why this kappa AB appears in this inversion. You can see that there's going to be a singularity at C3 equals zero, and in fact, that's the only singularity of the UCS system. And in a moment, I'll show you an interpretation for what these guys are. Okay, but they appear in the analysis of the UCS. Okay, so what does that mean that these are invertible relations? Well, it means that the full space, the full H dual here, is an orbit. The orbits are generically six-dimensional. Remember, the algebra is six-dimensional. You get 4 plus 2 from the GL2 and R2. And the fact that it's invertible means that this UCS has no Casimirs. Again, I'm just talking about the GL2 semi-direct R2. The claim is that that does not have Casimirs. There's no isotropy, and so the orbits are maximal. Okay, and the corresponding KKS symplectic form, if you just use the standard formula, you get this expression. But given these inversion formulas, you can write this as something that looks like a two-form. So I'll do that here. Okay, I mentioned before I get there, so that's the result. Before I get there, let me reiterate that I used this tensor, this GL2 invariant tensor kappa. And that has an interesting interpretation from the point of view of the extended corner symmetry. Remember that that's the SL2 semi-direct R2. Okay, what happens in the context of ECS is that epsilon is an invariant tensor, while C3 is a cubic Casimir. Okay, and this was a bit of a surprise that this Casimir emerged, but it definitely plays a central role. Okay, you can see here that this is a Casimir that is, it's very important that I have both rotations, GL2 rotations as well as SL2 rotations in this case, as well as translations. If I shut off the translations, then it just goes to zero. Okay, and good. So the symplectic form, as I said, can be written in terms of delta P's and delta J's. It turns out that it sort of splits up into two pieces. It splits up into a rank 4 piece plus a rank 2 piece. And what I've done here is I've separated out the traceless piece and a trace, which I call script J. And similarly, on the Lie algebra, I separated out the traceless part and a trace. And the W here is literally the trace of theta, so you should think about that as the vial element. Okay, and in fact, what's happening here is that log of this SL2 semi-direct R2 Casimir, it varies into W. Okay, so the bottom line then is that this symplectic form has sort of separated into stuff that's about the traceless stuff and stuff that's about the trace. Okay, and in fact, what's happening, so I'd like to understand an explanation for that fact, but just to anticipate the answer, it's going to turn out that this rank 4 part of the symplectic form is associated with ECS, with the orbits of the extended corner symmetry, okay, so finite distance corners, if you like, whereas this term is associated with the ACS orbits. Yep.
Can you go back a couple of slides? One more, yeah. So these are only, you said, generic orbits, six-dimensional, but did you say that you don't expect non-generic orbits? You will also have...
So in this case, there are sort of what you may call singular or exceptional orbits.
Yeah, if you go to the Weyl chamber, you look at the generations.
Yeah, so the only degeneration in this case is at C3 equals to zero.
I see.
Okay, and one way to see that is that if you compute the Pfaffian of the symplectic form, it's just equal to 1 over C3.
Okay.
Okay, and I'm not going to talk about those exceptional orbits, but okay. If you go there, you will find, you know, lower dimensional 4, 2, and 0
right.
dimensional orbits.
And when you say locally symplectic, what do you mean?
I mean that it's not globally symplectic for that reason, that there are singular orbits sort of off at infinity
each orbit is symplectic on the nose.
Each of these, well, if there wasn't this singularity, then this would be globally symplectic. There's a problem, remember C3 is one of the, if you like, log C3 is one of the coordinates on this orbit. There's a problem at infinity with that, which is where the singular orbits live.
That's a problem of the coordinate, not of the fact that the orbit is symplectic. I mean.
Well, there are such singularities in the system.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. You said the generic orbits are six-dimensional. Do you know how many generic orbits there are? Is there just one, or are there a couple?
Well, as far as I know, there's one, because there is no Casimir. It's just space filling, right?
So. Okay, so the non-generic ones don't, like, separate that space into separate orbits.
You mean the exceptional ones?
Yeah, the exceptional, they, in principle, could divide your space into...
No, it's just that there's a locus where the orbits happen to be lower dimensional. Okay, it's sort of a singular point.
Oh, yeah.
And in these coordinates, it's off at infinity.
So the generic orbit is...
If you just go to a generic point in the covector space, then you just see a six-dimensional tangent space, yes.
And you can get to every other generic point with the coadjoint
action. If you integrated along curves, okay. Yeah. Okay, my spell checking is failing me. So, to understand this 4+2 split of the symplectic form, let me talk a little bit about the corresponding orbit analysis for the ECS. Okay, so this is the case where the group is SL2 semi-direct to R2. That's a five-dimensional group. Okay, so the orbits can't be five-dimensional because they need to be symplectic. And when you do the analysis, what you find is a generic orbit is four-dimensional in this case, along which that C3 is constant. Okay, so that's the sense in which C3 is the principal Casimir for the ECS. Okay, and you can think about, at least at generic points, the dual space is being foliated by these symplectic four-dimensional leaves. Each labeled by a cubic Casimir, okay? And if you write down the KKS form for that analysis, you get a rank 4 symplectic form. The details are a little bit involved because you can't do this globally. You have to construct, you have to pick a patch of the, you have to pick some sort of coordinate patch. Here I don't remember why we did it the way we did it here, but this is one example. And the reason that it's a little bit complicated is precisely because there's a Casimir. Okay, the tangent vector components are not all independent, and you have to choose a way to solve for one of them in terms of the others in order to write the symplectic form.
Here the Casimir is C3, right?
Sorry?
The Casimir is your value of C3.
Yes.
So, okay, maybe it's just a remark more for discussion, but it's very interesting because if you compute what it is in the, you know, in the representation we have, it's going to be theta theta bar, which is exactly, so whether it's positive, negative, or null, decide whether the surface is going to be trapped or not. So it's kind of a, geometrically it's kind of remarkable that this is really the trapping condition of the surface.
Well, that's an interesting comment. So yeah, let's talk about
that. Yeah, that's.
Okay. So the details depend on how you perform this locally. But the point that I want to make is that this is a rank 4 form, and in fact you can, it's a rank 4 object, and you can think about that as coming from the 4 in the 4+2 split of the UCS symplectic form that I showed you earlier. Okay, similarly for ACS. I'm not going to show a lot of details of this, but in this case, remember the group is R semidirect R2. So the dual space is 3-dimensional. Again, that can't be an orbit because it couldn't be symplectic, and a generic orbit is 2-dimensional. Okay, so an example of the KKS form in this case, you can write on a patch where P0 is non-zero. The symplectic form just takes this simple form. It's basically a Heisenberg-type system where J and log P0 are playing the role of the coordinates. Okay. So there are multiple, from the point of view of UCS, there are multiple Casimirs in this case. And I didn't write them down here. This is discussed in detail in the paper. One Casimir is P1 over P0, because the P's have a vial weight, so the ratio is invariant. And then there's some more complicated Casimirs that appear as well. Okay, and this sort of rank 2 symplectic form can be thought of as coming from the second term in the 4+2 split of the UCS. Okay, and in fact, what's happening here is that HW, the one about ACS, and HS of the ECS group are actually ideals inside UCS. And as a result, their orbits are immersed in the full space, the full UCS space. And in fact, at a given point in H-dual, they're complementary. They sort of form a 4+2 split of the tangent space at a given point. Okay, so next what I want to do is I want to describe how to put back in diff-S. Okay, so sort of the most simple-minded way that you can think about this is that, well, you can just regard the analysis that I've done so far, as I said at the beginning, as sort of point by point on S. Okay, so the first thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to promote for a Lie algebra element, I'm going to promote the thetas and b's to be functions on S, and I'm also going to include a diffeomorphism on S. Okay, and so this is a parameterization of an element of the Lie algebra of the full UCS. The corresponding dual element then, similarly, the J's and P's become functions on S, and there's a one form that I'm calling alpha here as well. Okay, so the sigmas here are just local coordinates on S. Okay, so the invariant pairing of UCS with its dual, I'm going to write as M of X. And it's just what we had before, theta times j plus b times p, but now there's a contraction of the vector field with the form. And the invariant, the integrated expression, can then just be written as an integral over S of that inner product. Okay, and of course what you would like to do in a physical theory is interpret this as the image under some moment map of an integrated charge, H sub x. Okay, and in fact, the add action, you know, that acts on x and the add star action that acts on m, in fact implies the algebra of the charges as we've seen earlier. In this notation, that just corresponds to this expression. Remember that on the right-hand side, add x of y is just the Lie bracket of x and y, and so you should read this equation as this equation. And if you interpret the left-hand side, given that these are integrable charges, you can interpret the left-hand side in terms of a Poisson bracket. That would be the idea. Okay, so as I've mentioned before, there's a number of technical requirements for this to work out. I just mentioned one of them. One thing is that the charges need to be integrable for this system to be consistent, and we understand how to achieve that now through the extended phase space ideas that I didn't have time to review. Given a moment map, which I'll describe in a moment. Well, there are many details, but it could be that, you know, once you do that, you get a representation, a projective representation in general. And that will depend on details of how the moment map works, as well as a certain equivariant lifting. And this is, a description of this is work in progress, so I'm not going to go in that direction here. But what I do want to emphasize here is that what I've described here has a very nice interpretation in terms of a Lie algebroid. In fact, it's an Atiyah-Lie algebroid, where the base space is the corner S, and the structure group of the principal bundle associated with this Lie algebroid is this GL2 semidirect R2. Okay, so if you like this algebroid picture, I'm going to remind you what a Lie algebroid is in a second. If you like, though, that, you know, the GL2, in this context, you can think of the GL2 semidirect R2 as sort of the gauge group, and the base space is the corner. No chance. Okay, so here's a quick and dirty primer of Atiyah-Lie algebroids. The idea is that given a principal G bundle over a base space M with a principal connection, you can talk about the important place to look is the tangent bundle, right? And the problem is that the tangent bundle of P is a bundle over P. But if you mod by the right action of the group, you actually get a vector bundle over M. Okay, and this is the I'm going to refer to this as A. This is the Atiyah-Lie algebroid. And the principal connection on the principal bundle descends to a connection on this Lie algebroid. Okay, and the picture that you should have here is that in fact, given a connection, there's a short exact sequence, which basically tells you that you can think about this algebroid. Well, the connection defines a split of the algebroid into horizontal and vertical sub-vector bundles. But what this means is that you can think about a section of A as consisting of two types of things. One is a vector field or a diffeomorphism that comes from here, and the other is a sort of gauge transformation, if you like, or an element of the Lie algebra that comes from here. Okay, so what an Atiyah-Lie algebroid does is it combines together diffeomorphisms and Lie algebras in a nice compact geometric package. And you know, the transition functions on that vector bundle are just valued in diff M, the diffeomorphisms on M, semi-direct the structure group. Okay? And so in the context that we're speaking here, the idea is that the role of M here is played by the corner S. S is the base space. I'm supporting diffeomorphisms of that, changes of coordinates on the base. And the gauge group, or the structure group here, is GL2 semi-direct R2. Okay, so from this viewpoint, the thing that I called the Lie algebra element X of the full UCS, which had a diffeomorphism and a GL2 semi-direct R2 transformation in it, is just reinterpreted as a section of A. And what was the dual of the Lie algebra then is promoted to the dual bundle, A dual. Okay, so this is quite powerful because, well, you know, part of the point, you know, as we've discussed, of the orbit analysis is to get a handle on representation theory. Okay, and I'm not sure I've done that at this point, right? Because, you know, what I've learned from the orbit analysis is that you get a representation on Poisson brackets of the symmetry that you started with. Okay, but this algebraic picture gives you a sort of leg up, because just as in classical field theory, if you think about matter fields as corresponding to sections of bundles that are associated with a gauge bundle, here there will be associated bundles that correspond to specific representations of the algebraic. Okay, so the big picture here, which I cannot flesh out for you in the time that I have, and in fact I'm only hopeful at this point that this is work in progress, but you might imagine that given that you have an algebraic here, or underlying it a principal bundle, that there's some sort of functional integral quantization that you could define. It would be a gauge theory over corners, and the proposal would be that this is perhaps a quantum theory of gravity that comes entirely from corners. Okay, it turns out that there's an important example of a representation of this algebraic that I've discussed here, which is a rank 2 affine bundle that I'm going to call B. Okay, this sounds a little bit unusual, because normally when we have a principal bundle or the associated Lie algebraic, the associated bundles that we talk about are vector bundles, right? With the vector spaces, the representation spaces. And here, this is sort of a special case because the structure group has this semi-direct product structure. Okay, so there's a nice representation. Here psi is a section of this bundle B, and what I'm showing you is what the transformations are on overlaps of patches on S. Okay, and the transformation of the size is just an affine transformation. There's a GL2 rotation and a translation. Okay, you also get a connection on this bundle for free, which is a sort of pair of connections. This is a translation, this is an R2 connection, and this is a GL2 connection. And, well, okay, so I don't have time to go into the details of this, but basically if you have a section of a dual, you can think about this. There's a standard morphism to what's called a derivation on this associated bundle. So you can relate things in a dual to things, to basically endomorphisms of this, of the dual bundle. Okay, so let me say a couple of words about moment maps. Okay, so the generic picture here is that they relate a phase space to the dual space. Now the dual space is this dual Lie algebraic. And in this context, what one finds is that there are moment maps that come from restricting to ECS or ACS. Okay, we haven't, I don't think there's a usable moment map for the full group itself, but there are moment maps that correspond to these groups that correspond to finite distance or asymptotic corners. Okay, and essentially what happens is I referred to the fact that you can think about a dual as these endomorphisms. Essentially, what happens in the case of ECS is that the invariant tensor epsilon allows you to map from that sort of data to a symmetric form on this bundle. And so I've referred to these as H0AB and H1A. A symmetric form turns out to be a pair like that. Okay, and what's happening here is that you can think about those things as pieces of the metric on a classical spacetime. So what appears to be happening here is that this affine bundle, a representation of the algebraid, gives you a natural moment map that builds for you a local picture of a classical spacetime. Okay, and you can go through the details of the charges, but it works out very cleanly. Okay, these are formulas that appear in papers by Laurent and friends, and also in our earlier papers as well, but they're sort of recontextualized here. Okay, so good. So let me just finish up with a few remarks. So as we've seen, the co-adjoint orbit analysis for UC is quite tractable, and it's useful to think about this in terms of a Lie algebraid over a corner. And there are associated representations, this affine representation in particular, that contain ingredients to build classical geometries. Okay, and in that context, the corners are codimension 2 within that affine bundle. Okay, and in fact, you can fit this into any diff-invariant classical theory. I've just described one situation here. Okay, you can also imagine, as I said before, that you can think about this as perhaps the starting point for a quantum theory. Okay, so I'm imagining that I don't know the details yet, so I won't go into too much detail, but I'm imagining that there's some prescription for gluing these algebraids together that corresponds to some sort of functional integral. And the idea here, I guess, is that classical spacetimes would be reconstructed as a sort of condensate of corners in the context of these affine bundles. Okay, so the functional integral would somehow glue these things together into classical spacetimes. Okay, maybe a simpler idea is to simply go back and think about the co-adjoint analysis in the traditional sense and try to figure out, well, what representations here are actually correspond to unitary unitary representations. And I don't have much to say about this, but this would sort of correspond to a canonical quantization. And that may be, it's certainly of interest to think along those lines as well. Now, for example, this sort of picture presumably, which is what will map onto the quantization of asymptotics in linearized gravity. Okay, and let me just finish with a couple of comments. You know, one of the things that Laurent mentioned yesterday or emphasized yesterday was a fluid picture. And one word of caution, I guess, is that he was sort of focusing on diff-S semi-direct SL2, having discarded the translations. And it's not the case that Casimirs of SL2 become Casimirs necessarily of the larger group. But nevertheless, we've seen that the corner charges are well-defined invariants of the full thing, and there are other invariants as well. For example, the volume of S, you're just integrating one, and one is certainly an invariant, a local invariant. But there are other integrated curvature invariants that you could imagine as well. And these are In my language, this is what, you know, Laurent was calling entropies and related objects. Okay, and well, as we know, one of the appealing features of this corner program is that it emphasizes entanglement and the non-factorizability of the Hilbert spaces. It may be related, it may give insights on the information puzzles, et cetera. Okay, I will stop there, almost on time.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob. We have time for one or two questions.
Hey, thank you. So you explained how everything should be thought of as a group theoretic, that the metric emerges in the cohesion interpretation of or at least the cohesion orbit of the group. And I guess something I'm missing in the picture is where is the dynamics? Like where does even if you wanted to build a path integral, you would want to weight it by, you know, some dynamical action.
Right.
Where is this hidden in the formalism?
Well, so one ingredient that you traditionally get from Lagrangian is the symplectic structure, and that comes through the moment map from the KKS symplectic structure. So in some sense, that's built in. Constraints are constraints. But it's, well, I mean, it would have to be emergent, right? This is not, I'm not writing a path integral for a theory on a space-time M, right? That's not the picture. That would have to be an interpretation of the quantum theory that I, you know, that hopefully will come out of this. So, well, it's a complicated question. It, in some sense, it's, you might think of this as analogous to what happens in string theory, where you know, the perturbative string is a world sheet theory, and there's an effective target space theory that you could imagine quantizing small fluctuations on. It's, in some sense, it's maybe analogous to that. In detail, no, but in as an analogy, perhaps.
Thank you.
Yeah, so your analysis applies to any diff invariant theory. So you said that you can recover WBMS, but for instance, these W1 plus infinity symmetries, infinite dimensional symmetries that are there, could you imagine that maybe they may be related to the fact that the hypothesis of looking for a finite dimensional corner symmetry is too small, and there may be another closed sector that is,
well,
infinite dimensional?
I mean, I guess I would say diff S is a big place, right? So,
you think it's already inside diff S? It may be already there.
It will be there, yeah.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time.
Laurent,
we're running out of time.